Well, as you know, Mr. Page is away at a conference, and he's asked me to stand in for the next two periods. that is today and on Monday. I took Ancient Israel class last semester, and I think I missed one or two classes. I believe you finished at the difference of, or the problem period between Baasha and Asa, and the answer to that. I will skip that. I'll let Mr. Page answer that when he comes back, all right? I want to pick up a little further ahead of that in the... it's only a very short answer anyway, so I don't suppose it will cause a problem. I didn't happen to particularly study that at this time. So I will pick up at the period of time of the northern kingdom of Israel. I want you just to briefly recap to remind you that Jeroboam, of course, rebelled against Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and we will see in time, or you should know in time, that after Jeroboam's death, Nadab became the king. He was assassinated, and then Baasha became king, and his son succeeded him, who was also assassinated. Now, as we look down the family line, we see at this period of time a very, very powerful king come into being. That is, if you turn to 1 Kings chapter 16, 1 Kings chapter 16 and verses 15, I won't read them all, but I will ask you to do so, verses 15 through 28. And here we have the period of time of great strength in the northern kingdom, and the house of Omri, verse 15 of 1 Kings chapter 16. In the 27th year of Asa, the king of Judah, did Zimri reign 7 days in Tirzah, and the people were encamped against Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. And the people heard, and the people that were encamped heard, say, Zimri has conspired and has also slain the king. Wherefore all Israel made Omri the captain of the host over the king of Israel that day in the camp. And so we see then that Omri, the captain, became the king of Israel. That's a very important aspect to realize there. We see in verse 21 that the people of Israel divided into two parts. This is in fact part of the answer here of King Asa. I'll let Mr. Page fill it in. But they divided into two parts. Half of the people followed Tibni and the son of Ginath to make him king, and half followed Omri. The people who followed Omri prevailed against the people who followed Tibni, the son of Ginath, and so Tibni died and Omri reigned. So here we have then, in the 31st year of Asa, the king of Judah, began Omri to reign over Israel 12 years, 6 years he reigned in Tirzah. The important thing about this is that Omri then became a king, and he had been the leading general in the Israelitish army. He became king, his family became an extremely powerful family, and even after Omri was dead, the Assyrians referred to him and to the following kingdom, or the kings in their kingdom of Israel, as the house of Omri, as the house of Omri. And in fact, two terms, whoops, I nearly called the mic out. Two terms are used very frequently, Bit Humri, and the other one is Beit Humri, B-E-I-T. When I was discussing this with Mr. Page, I said it reminds me of the Welsh term Cymru. Cymru am Byth. Cymru means Wales, Wales forever. But it is recorded that both of these terms are used historically after the time of Omri. The Bible actually says very little about Omri's reign. It does say in verse 25, he wrought evil in the eyes of God and did worse than were all before him. A very important statement to see what type of individual he was. And verse 28, Omri slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria. Ahab, his son, reigned in his stead. Now, Omri's reign was a very prosperous one. Anyone happen to know the territory or the place or the city that Omri established? Samaria, okay. The capital, of course, that had been established by his father or his grandfather, Samaria. And this was taken as his capital in approximately circa 870 BC. And he was a very great architect. He designed and built, as kings are wont to do, Herod the Great, notwithstanding, whose architecture today is still standing as a sign of his, quote, greatness. He wasn't liked for very much else, but Herod the Great did do a tremendous amount of building in Israel this summer when we were at I can't think of what you call those places in Israel that they have, the hotel where we stayed, Mizpah, what do they call it? The kibbutz, thank you, slipped my mind, the kibbutz, Mizpah in Jerusalem, could look out of my bedroom window. I don't know if you two could, Donna and Hope, but see the Herodium sticking up on the hill, a massive building. Do you remember that? We went and saw the Herodium. You don't remember that? Oh my goodness, one of the great sights. Do you remember that? Sticking up. I got a beautiful photograph of it with my telescopic lens. You must have been asleep all the time. That was your problem. Anyway, this is a heritage which Herod left. He left a lot of other bad things, but this was a good thing that he left. We also saw, of course, traces of his buildings all over the place. We traveled down Jericho, of course, Masada and so forth. All right. What caused, then, this period of time to be a prosperous one in Israel? You should know the answer to this if I know Mr. Page in his teaching.
Trade route.
Oh, how could you? I can't understand that. All right. That's right, the trade routes. You've got the point. Oh, boy. Well done, Mr. Page. The trade routes, those come up all the time. And what happened was Omri created an alliance between both his own territory, Israel, and Tyre. And Tyre was, of course, as I hope you should know, on the coastline, the island. It was a trading empire, and as a result of that, you can think back to the time when you created alliances, that you did so by sealing it with a marriage. Think back to the time of Solomon. Solomon, of course, had an alliance with Pharaoh, and he married Pharaoh's daughter. as well as many other people, to the point, of course, they had 700 wives and 300 concubines, which was absolutely ridiculous. But in this particular case, we have the king of Tyre producing a princess, and her name, as we shall see, she married the son of Omri. Jezebel married Ahab. Okay? So Israel was in a dominant position at this time. Since the female was produced from the inferior empire or kingdom, then Israel was in the dominant one, which makes it surprising, or I think Mr. Page probably mentioned this, when Solomon was in a dominant position over Egypt, and Egypt produced the female in the alliance and sealed the alliance with a marriage. This happened typically throughout the entirety of Europe. If you go back and check Queen Victoria's marriages, she was very, very particular, not her own marriages, but the marriages she arranged within the royal family. Many, many alliances all throughout Europe were made, and the family was very intertwined, so much so that if you look at the Tsar Peter III, the one that was tragically put to death, at least according to the sources that I have read, he and his family, you'll see that he looks very, very much, now Tsar Peter III looked very, very much like George the VI, a very, very close family resemblance. So it was a typical thing which had been carried on down many, many generations. All right, so we have Tyre producing a princess, her name was Jezebel, in this particular context. She married Ahab, the son of Omri. And in Judah there was another alliance. Athaliah was the one that married Ahaziah, the son of Jehoshaphat. Okay? So we have the triple alliance, Israel, Judah, and Tyre together. And Israel was in the dominant position. Israel was in control of the eastward trade routes, or routes, and they expanded their territory further eastward and also conquered Moab and took the King's Highway. All right? I presume you've got your maps and you can see where that territory is. Moab over the east side of Jordan and south. Judah also expanded south and conquered the Via Maris, the Philistines. Okay, they were taken over. And you can see then with the expansion of territory, the control of the trade routes, therefore it was a time of prosperity, as in Judah not only expanded southward, but also eastward to take over Edom. And the result was, of all of this activity, that by approximately 860 BC, that the majority of what God, majority of what Solomon, rather, had controlled, that God had blessed him with, that he inherited from David, had come back to the nation of Israel and Judah. The majority of what he had controlled. There was one area that did not come back. That area was up in the north and the east, and the northern part going up to the Euphrates. That had not quite come back. And the other areas, though, all came back into Israel and Judah's hands. Now, there is a saying, and it's a very, very true one, because while we have prosperity, then people forget from whence they get prosperity, and they fall into sin. And in one sense, sin is for the good times. The United States, and I think there's a very close analogy here, is also in this position, where sin is for the good times. This country has totally forgotten its founding. The religious beginning that this nation had, and it's gone very, very far from that today. The same thing, of course, happened to Israel. They went into apostasy. And we must ask the question during Ahab's rule, why did Israel go into apostasy? The answer, of course, is very clear by what I mean by apostasy. It's, of course, sin and worshipping pagan gods. The reason for Israel doing this is made clear in verses 29 through 31 and 32. 29 and in the third, 38th year of King Asa of Judah began Ahab the son of Omri to rule over Israel. And Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel, Samaria, 22 years. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him. And it came to pass as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. What did Jeroboam the son of Nebat do that was so wrong? Okay. Yes, in both north and south Israel, he set up the golden calves, established Samaria as the headquarters. The object, I think you've been through this, that people did not need then to go down to Jerusalem to keep the feast. It was a religious prevention, okay? It was the point of the calf. We'll keep the people here. We don't want them going to Jerusalem. All right, so Jeroboam then set up the golden calves, and carry on verse 31. And he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. Now, as I hope we may be aware, that when a king married a princess to seal this alignment, by right, as you also would have known from the time of Solomon, the princess had the right to bring her religion with her, which of course Jezebel did. And as a result of that, there was, in Solomon's time, many temples set up for the worship of these various princesses that he married, so they may worship whoever they wish to worship. In this case, of course, Jezebel was a Baal worshipper. And not only with that, but with our first problem here, the apostasy of Israel, Jeroboam not only began the corruption of the worship set up in Samaria by the two golden calves, but now also his son Ahab continued it on to a point of great problem. What is wrong with this? What is the problem with allowing this type of situation to exist in the nation? Anyone have an answer for that question? Why should we not do this? Why does God say don't do it? Anyone think of a scripture as to why you should not allow pagan worship? Why you should not allow your wife to do you, John?
Draws your heart away from God, like Solomon's heart was drawn away.
All right. It does draw your heart away from God. That's true, Bill. Well, that is a true principle. I don't know necessarily if that's applicable in this case. Okay, let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Because God very clearly in his instructions here gives us the answer. And I suppose it's appropriate to say while we're bombarded around us with Christmas cheer, and the big sell, we need to bear this in mind. It's appropriate. And at any other time of the year, verse 29, when the Lord your God shall cut off the nations from before you where you go to possess them, and you succeed them and dwell in their land, which of course they had done at the time context we're talking about, then take heed to yourself that you be not snared by following after them, that they be destroyed from before you. Okay? Do not be snared by following them after that they be destroyed before you. I'm sorry, I read that badly. And that you inquire not after their God, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. All right, we don't need to, and we should not, as it were, inquire per se, well, why are they doing this? We don't need to do that, he says. We will be likely to do likewise, he says. Verse 31, you shall not do so even unto the Lord your God. For every abomination to the Lord which he has, have they done unto their gods. For even their son and their son daughters have they burnt in the fire to their gods. And the Molech particularly was one that had this terrible sacrifice. Whatsoever thing I command you observe to do it, you shall not add thereto nor diminish from it. And I think we need to realize very clearly that when we look at the so-called Christian religions that we have in society today, and you read this statement, do not add to it nor take away from it, and if we see what has been added to and taken away, no longer is God's word inspired and the total sum of inspiration. It is now added to a lot, particularly the traditions of the fathers, other inspired writings, etc. So, not only did ancient Israel make this mistake, but we have made the same mistake and are making the same mistake today in our so-called Christian religions. So here we have Jezebel come into the scene. She was quite a lady, and she was very zealous at worshipping Baal. She took care of, sponsored, supported the priests of Baal. And what Ahab did, go on to chapter 16 of 1 Kings here, and verse 32, and he reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made a grove, and Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. So the problem was that, of course, the leadership of Ahab and the influence of his wife bringing the nation to a point of absolute paganism. Of course, this nation, not all that long before, had been tremendously blessed under the rulership of Solomon. And, did they have that much of an excuse? And the answer was no. So the first problem in the Ahab's rule was that of apostasy. Now, we see the case, or the example of Elisha, chapter 17, and he has the opportunity now to talk to the people of this very, very famous case. We won't read chapter 17 because it's not there. It's the barrel of meal chapter. The chapter 18 of the case of confronting the nation and indeed the king and queen in default are about this subject of Baal. Now, what was the situation? Here the nation was in complete unadulterated religious confusion. All right, and we see here, as it came to pass in verse 1 of chapter 18, after many days the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. Elijah went and showed himself to Ahab, and there was a sore famine in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, the governor, and now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. I think we can skip over this, come to the place a little quicker. Elijah, in verse 17, came to pass when Ahab saw him, Ahab said to him, "Are you he that troubles Israel?" The trouble being, of course, that Israel was in a drought and had been for 3 years, and God had cut the water supply off. And we see here, if we have read the story, I don't know how many of you have read ahead, we see the situation where Elijah and Ahab have a confrontation. Let me ask you a question. Who inspired the confrontation? Well, Jezebel. What does it say? Okay. All right. I think it was, if you'll look very carefully, okay.
Elijah,
verse 17. Elijah came to Ahab and said, "Who are you that troubled Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed Balaam." So we see then the confrontation is brought about by Elijah. And I find it a little strange, although I can understand it humanly. A little later on in Elijah's life, he got very, very frightened and ran away. In this particular case, though, extremely brave. God was with him. Why are you troubling Israel? Elijah said, okay, you think I'm troubling Israel? The problem is you have forsaken God and you're worshipping Baal. Verse 19, "Now therefore send and gather me all Israel unto Mount Carmel." Why Mount Carmel? All right.
That was the seat of Baal's worship. Baal was
strong. Okay, this was supposed to be the home territory of Baal. This was his place of deity, and if you'll remember, I'm sure, again, Mr. Page has made this clear many times, that, first of all, this god, Baal, was supposed to be most powerful on his own territory. You remember what happened to the Ark of the Covenant when it was taken to the house of Dagon, they put it in the house of Dagon, and in the morning, Dagon was fallen down, he was broken off from the fish tail, and the hands and the head were broken off. This was God showing, hey, Dagon is not the strongest, I am in fact the strongest. Here was Elijah making the confrontation on Mount Baal, Mount Carmel, which was Baal's most sacred territory. And as we look at this situation that Elijah confronted Ahab with, we must realize that the situation of pagan religion was being addressed head on. The point about it, number one, being on Baal's own territory, so to speak. It was like the basketball playing on the home team turf. And the second one, which comes out of this, was an opportunity for Baal, if he was there, to show, and his priests, to show what, in fact, he could do. So the confrontation is a very important one. And God gave, or Elijah gave the prophets of Baal, the first go at calling him up and, of course, letting him have his chance to show his strength. Now we see here in verse 19, "Now therefore send and gather me all Israel unto the Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal 450, and the prophets of the groves 400, which eat at Jezebel's table." I mentioned that very briefly. Of course, there's here we have 850 people, religious men, etc., etc. "And Ahab sent to all of the children of Israel, and gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. And Elijah came unto all the people and said, How long halt you between two opinions?" Now, the problem here is a slight translation problem. "Halt you" does not really tell us what was meant by that. "Halt you" is an old English term. Actually, the verb in the Hebrew means to hop back and forth. In other words, it had got to a place in Israel where they did not know the difference between Yahweh, or Yahweh, and Baal. They did not know which one was God. And this was the problem. They did not know which one was God. As a result of that, they were sort of jumping back and forth. They just didn't know. And again, to repeat Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 29, these people have been well sucked into, as a result of the leadership of the nation and the philosophy of the day which came down to them, that, of course, it was all right to do this and mix worship to the point where God did not mean anything to them. Yahweh did not mean anything. And he says, how long do you hop back and forth between these two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. In other words, do one thing or the other. Quite simply, do one thing or the other. And so, to make the point, to prove the point, and to demonstrate the point, we have Elijah saying, all right, you go ahead, you do, with your 850 voices, all you want to do, you call on Baal, and let's see what Baal will do on his own special territory, on his own special turf. And so they called on the names of Baal, and they screamed, and they shouted, and they cut themselves and slashed themselves. And in verse 27, it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is talking, or he's pursuing, or he is in a journey, or perhaps he sleeps and must be woken. So why don't you shout a bit louder, see if you can wake Baal up. It's almost like someone walking into the Vatican, and here's the Pope sitting on his throne, and the Pope is able to perform miracles, and of course he claims that he's representative of God. And in St. Peter's, in the middle of the Vatican, where it's the holy territory, he tries to perform miracles and can't. And so he says to all of the priests and the nuns and the Pope, scream a bit louder. Maybe God will hear you. And then in the middle of all of these people, and, you know, I personally think it would have taken an enormous amount of courage to do this, mocking and ridicule them, as Elijah certainly did, among all these people surrounded, outnumbered, the local people, whoever was gathered there, as it said, call all Israel, many, many people there, and here you're the one and only type. And as we go on to see, that they cried, they cut themselves in a manner, the bravery of standing out alone, and these people are going on, and they, crying out, cut themselves in a manner with knives and lances till blood gushed out upon them. Rather grotty and a gruesome scene here. The mocking really was drawing the point, you know, he said, well, perhaps Baal is asleep, really drawing the point, what is the psalm we sing? That, of course, our eternal God does not slumber and does not sleep. Apparently, Baal did. And but certainly, God did not. We have the case where, of course, I won't go through and read all of the verses here. Again, I'll let you do that. Elijah took the 12 stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel, and then he built the altar with them and put the wood on the bullocks, and he poured the water over it and soaked it down. And then, within just a very, very short period of time, late in the afternoon, after very clearly, number one, Baal on his own territory did not do a thing, then we have Elijah's prayer. And this was verse 36. As we can time it, I think it takes about 21 or 22 seconds. What an absolute contrast between all day and just a few seconds. The Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that you art the Lord God, and that you have turned their heart back again. End of prayer. Just a few seconds, and then God poured out supernaturally fire upon it, and of course it ate up, consumed all the dust and wood and the water in the trench. And then when the people saw it, then they had this incredible contrast of realizing there was absolutely no question whatsoever that indeed Yahweh is God. Now, what would you feel at this period of time when you had been put through a day's ranting and raving, religiously speaking, to your God that you had been worshipping, that the people who were leading the nation told you was the God you should be worshipping, and all the rest of it. What would be your emotional reaction to this?
Kill the falcon.
Well, that's what they did, but what is your emotional reaction?
I would, as far as on the priests, pagan priests, I'd feel betrayed.
You'd feel betrayed. You'd feel very angry, doesn't it? It'd bring out some very high emotions here, that once the true God is shown to you, you get pretty mad. I mean, after all, what had Baal done for them, in quotes? They had 3 years of drought. They had a famine. All the years that they'd been worshipping Baal, giving their tithes and offerings and gifts to him, how would you feel? Hey, you mean we've been wasting our money all this time? All of our efforts and time and praying and all the rest of it. There was 3 years of drought. Why was the drought for 3 years significant? Anyone know the particular reason why the drought in itself was significant? All right. Let's ask what quality was Baal, was attributed to Baal?
He was the
God of rain. Okay, the God of rain. So we see then the second reason why this was so dramatic. The God of rain. So here he comes to verse 41 of 1 Kings 18, and Elijah said unto Ahab, get you up, okay, and eat and drink, for there is a sound of the abundance of rain. And so Ahab went up to eat and to drink, and Elijah went to the top of Carmel, cast himself down on the earth, and put his face between his knees, and he said to his servant, go up and look and see, tell me what you see. We need a little bit of, better take my thing with me, a little bit of geography here. As you'll know that the coastline comes down like this, and we have Mount Carmel is in fact a very long, skinny, sausage-like thing. Valley of Jezreel is here, and do you remember looking over the Valley of Jezreel this summer? Oh, good. We had Sabbath services on Mount Carmel. Mr. Page gave a sermon, and you could look over and see the Valley of Jezreel. And at a time like this, when you do that, the Bible, of course, comes alive. Somewhere, we're not sure exactly where on here, where the confrontation took place, but it wasn't right at the end here. He sent his messenger, his servant, seven times. Said, look, see, it's interesting to me, the scripture here. Elijah said to Ahab, get you up, for the sound of the abundance of rain. There is the sound of the abundance of rain. Hadn't obviously yet heard it. And seven times he sent him to have a look to see if he could see some evidence of rain. What would you expect he was looking for? Clouds. Clouds. Okay, yes, obviously the story tells us, doesn't it? Came to pass the seventh time, he said, behold, there arise a little cloud out of the sea. And we have the prevailing winds coming off the sea and bringing in moisture onto the land. And, of course, if this had not happened for 3 years, with the rain not coming at all, then it would be indeed a remarkable thing, putting your evidence directly against Baal, who was supposed to produce rain, who was a god of thunders and storms and rain. And so the seventh time, the little cloud came, and Elijah said to Ahab, prepare your chariot, get you down, that the rain stop you not. Okay, what was the point behind this? Well, of course, as we can see, the highest point was where they were worshipping Baal, and of course they had to go look for the cloud, had to get down from the mountain, and we should know that, at least I hope we know that there were two palaces, one in Samaria and one in Jezreel, that King Ahab had. But the point was that the plains obviously became very marshy. One of the things that the people in Israel, the Jews that emigrated to Israel, did was to buy up this land, to drain it, to put irrigation or drainage dishes in there, and it is today a very beautiful and a very rich, prosperous area, agriculturally speaking. And so Elijah was saying, listen, get in your chariot, get down and get back to your palace, because if you don't, you're going to get caught in the rain. And it explains, I think, a little bit here, how, if we can read verses 45 and 46, came to pass, and meanwhile the heaven went black with the clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. Ahab rode and went to Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. And if we can just see from the explanation here how that can take place, of course we assume that he went across to Jezreel in this direction, and no doubt was slowed down, went around, and Elijah could run straight across and get there quickly and reach there at the same time as Ahab. All right, so we see then that the Jezebel wanted Baalism on the same level as God, as Yahwehism. And the point about it was, this whole confrontation was to uproot the Baalism out of the nation. And Baalism was rooted out at that time. Okay, so we have a cleansing in that sense of the nation. Now we have a second problem which arises at this time in Israel. The second problem I mentioned very briefly when I said sin was for good times. The second problem was not necessarily sin, although that's a perpetually a problem, but that of prosperity. If you want to curse a nation, give it prosperity. I mentioned in the introduction that Israel was very wealthy, very prosperous at this time. And the prosperity of that shows through in the example of Naboth and his vineyard. Let's skip over chapter 20 to chapter 21. Look at the second point here, the prosperity that was in the nation at the time. As I mentioned, Ahab had two palaces, one in Samaria and one in Jezreel. And it came to pass after these things that Naboth, the Jezreelite, so here we see where the second palace was, and he had a vineyard which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab the king, Samaria. A Jezreelite just simply is someone that comes from Jezreel. So right alongside King Ahab's palace was this vineyard. And Ahab said unto Naboth, give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give you for it a better vineyard than it. Or, if it seems good to you, I will give you the worth of it in money. Now, on the surface, this looks like an innocent enough request. It's a financial transaction. What can be the problem? First of all, let's analyze Ahab's desire. It was close by his palace. And secondly, it was also, he wanted it for a herb garden. Now, on a normal business deal, there wouldn't be any problem with this, would there? There wouldn't be any problem with this. And as we go in to see in verse 3, Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid it, that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto you. Now, Ahab came to his house heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. So here he was, king of Israel. Here he was, unable to purchase this vineyard, however big it was, hard by or close by the side of his palace. He says, no, I'll not give it to you, inheritance from my fathers. And he laid him down upon his bed. He turned his face and would eat no bread. Poor, poor Ahab. Goes to bed and pouts, looking at the wall. I've actually talked to people who have not been, as a result of a purchase, pouting. But one woman I counseled that particularly comes to mind said that she, her husband died. She became so lonely that one day she decided she was going to die. And she lay in bed and she turned her face away from the window and closed her eyes and wished to die. And she stayed there and she stayed there and she stayed there. And finally she gave up and got up and said, well, I guess I'm not going to die. And began getting on with life a little bit. But here is emotional immaturity. And Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said unto him, why is your spirit so sad that you eat no bread? And he said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite, said to him, give me my vineyard for money, or if it pleases you, I'll swap you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I won't give you my vineyard. And Jezebel, his wife, said unto him, do you now govern the kingdom of Israel? You mean you're the king, you're in charge, and you can't take over this little vineyard. Well, what was the thing preventing Ahab from doing that? Naboth had said, God forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto you. The problem was that this particular inheritance was a piece of land which had been given to Joshua and the dividing of the land, and it was a special Hebrew word, Nahalah, which meant that it for no reason could that land be forced away from the rightful owners. And so in the story we see that indeed what had happened, or what did happen, was that Jezebel got into the act, and in all probability came to know, to understand, what Nahalah, N-A-H-A-L-A-H, what Nahalah meant. The inheritance of the fathers, a very, very special land. And Jezebel, supposing that, okay, if he has, he's not going to get it this way, I'll get it for him another way. So what did she do? She set up the situation, and you can see in verse 13, two men, children of Belial, an Old Testament terminology for worthless, useless people, sat before him, and the men of Belial witnessed against him and even against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth did blaspheme God and the king. And they carried him out to the city, stoned him with stones that he died. The message behind this, quite simply, is this. The only way that you could get Nahalah land was as a result of cursing or blaspheming both God and the king. As a result of this, your property was taken away from you. It was confiscated. So we can see in this situation how bad things were. Did Ahab really need Naboth's vineyard? And the answer is no, he didn't. We can see the wickedness and the evil of Ahab in doing this. We can see the problem that ensued as a result of allowing his wife not only to bring in Baalism, but also to, let's say, go ahead and do things which were wicked and evil against God's law, and as a result of that, caused the death of an innocent man. One of the students at Imperial asked me a question, not in relation to this, but that bears on this particular principle. Why is it that Naboth, apparently an innocent man, suffers in this sort of situation? Why does God allow this thing to happen? And as I pointed out to them, that God allows many, many things to happen in this type of situation to innocent people. And time and chance, if you will, or permitting the circumstance to come about, that an object lesson, in this case, history may be written. And, of course, they, yes, are the innocent victim. They're not sinless, but they are permitted to be the innocent victim in a particular case for the object lesson. And they will have their opportunity for salvation, of course, in God's time. But the point is that Ahab knew what was going on. I think this might be a good place to stop, because the next section I wanted to cover was Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. Perhaps we can begin that and then carry on Monday. That Ahab knew what was going on. He was an accessory before the fact. He knew what he was doing and did nothing about it. All right, that's, I think, taken care of. Any questions on Naboth's vineyard and all the rest of it? All right, so just to reiterate that number one problem, of course, the mixture of paganism and God, Yahweh, and number two, the one of wealth. All right, I want you to turn to chapter 20, and we'll just quickly look. We've got a couple of minutes to set the stage for Monday. Ben-Hadad, the king of Assyria, gathered all his host together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up to besiege Samaria and war against it. Setting a scene that this takes place all the time with humanity, as I'm sure we're getting the impression as we go through ancient Israel, it's a continual power struggle. Ben-Hadad was in charge of the empire. There were 32 vassal kings, 32 vassal kings that he had conquered and were in agreement with him. And Ahab, he sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, in the city, and said unto him, thus says Ben-Hadad, your silver and your gold is mine, your wives and your children, and even the goodliest are mine. What he means by this is, okay, I'm going to take away your silver and gold. Your wives, well, in this hostile takeover, the wives, the symbol of a king's wealth, were taken and put in the harem of the conquering king, and this was a demonstration of his power and his strength and his might. So the wives were his also, and your children, even the goodliest are mine. The children, well, they were presented at royal courts, and you surrounded yourself at your royal court with your vanquished, and as a victor, and the more you had, then, of course, the more powerful you were, and the greater the king you were. Verse 4, and the king of Israel answered and said, oh, my lord, what do you want? And what tribute do you want from me? And verse 5, the messengers came again. Thus spoke Ben-Hadad, because we can see here that Ahab was willing to pay a tribute. So, okay, don't let's fight about this. You're bigger and stronger and better looking than I am. How much can I pay you? And, of course, the messenger came back. Although I have sent unto you, saying, you shall deliver me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children, yet will I send my servants unto you tomorrow about this time, and they shall search your house and the houses of your servants, and it shall be that whatsoever is pleasant in your eyes, they shall put it in their hand and take it away. Clearly, the underlying message here by Ben-Hadad was, hey, I'm rejecting your offer of a tribute. I'm going to come in and take everything. Okay, let's read ahead in chapter, and we'll discuss the remainder on Monday.